Welcome to one of Kathy Frey's Motherwise podcasts. Kathy is a best-selling maternity author and award-winning international maternity consultant. During her time as a midwife, she's caught hundreds of babies. So you're in good hands. Enjoy.
Hi, everybody. It's Kathy Frey from Motherwise again. And today we are talking about day two after having a baby. So welcome to this webinar podcast. And welcome to my live audience as well. It's always great going live because you can ask questions or put the questions up and I'll be getting back to you on the answers with those. The live part is part of our essential basics, which of course you know all about. So tell your friends as well. Okay, day two after having a baby, very weirdly, is also often called day one. So that's just to add confusion, because day one can often be called day zero. Yes, I guess it all sort of just depends on the facility where you're staying postnatally. But generally, kind of if a baby is born after lunchtime, that first evening is called day zero, which means the next day is called day one, but it's actually day two, but then it can be anyway. So if we just call it somewhere around that, you know, 30 to 50 hours old or something like that, just a good general guideline. So firstly, I want to talk about you, the mum, and what's happening with you, and then we're going to talk about the baby, because they have suddenly become the center of your universe. All right, so firstly, you. Now, your blood pressure should be taken a couple of times a day, just to basically make sure that it's not suddenly creeping up. Because preeclampsic toxemia does not happen only in pregnancy. It can also actually happen after having a baby. And if somebody has had preeclampsic toxemia before they gave birth, they are at even higher risk of it turning into eclampsia, meaning fitting, after a baby is born. So if a woman's had preeclampsic toxemia in pregnancy, she absolutely should be having her blood pressure monitored very vigilantly over that first week after having a baby. But for most women, obviously most women, it's absolutely fine, but it should still be checked. So you also should have your temperature and your pulse regularly checked, because either of those getting elevated can be a sign that you're getting having an infection, which would most likely be caused from a womb infection postnatally. And the commonest cause of that is because there's a little bit of placenta or a little bit of membrane, or what we call retained products of conception, still left in the womb. So after the placenta is birthed, it is always checked and to make sure that it looks like it's intact. But boy, let me tell you, sometimes it's kind of hard to tell, especially if the membranes are a little bit ragged, and so it's impossible to know for sure that all of the membranes did come out. So yes, your temperature and your pulse should be checked. So if you certainly are feeling like you are getting a fever, then you absolutely should be checking in with someone, with your maternity postnatal caregiver. On saying that, it's absolutely normal as well for when a woman's full milk is starting to come in that she does get a little bit of a mild temperature. So that's fine. You shouldn't be feeling unwell with it at all. You're just sort of probably feeling a little bit flushed. But if you're actually feeling unwell, like you've got flu-like symptoms, then that could be something more serious. Now, your vaginal loss, obviously, your bleeding, or what we call your lochia, is going to be monitored. Now, it's absolutely normal to pass clots. There is nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's really quite good. And if you are feeling a bit off and a bit crampy, sometimes passing the clots is like, oh, that feels so much better. And they are the freakiest thing to look at when you've never seen one before. Honestly, it looks like a lump of liver, but that's a clot in it. They're better out than in. And anything up to the size of an egg is common and regarded as normal. So yeah, that's kind of weird. And you're most likely to pass them when you are breastfeeding or going to the toilet. And you just hear this plop into the bowl of the toilet and you're like, what is that? That's a clot, probably, yes. So anyway, that's absolutely normal, better out than in, and as I say, anything up to about the slightly normal. Your fundal height, so that is the top of your womb, what level that's at. It's usually at your umbilicus or your belly button, straight after having a baby, and it tends to go down about 1 centimeter or 1 finger width a day or thereabouts. Each time your caregiver sees you in those days following having a baby, they'll just have a little feel of your tummy and make sure that your fundus is, or the top of your womb, is sitting where it should be. And then, of course, there will be around day 2, 3, or 4, those, particularly about days 2 or 3, is the postnatal blues will be hitting in, which we'll talk more about. But basically, that's absolutely normal. It is not a depressive disorder at all. It happens to 4 out of 5 women, and it's really simply because you had absolutely seismic changes to the hormone levels within your body. So kind of, you know, when you drop your estrogen levels by thousands of percents, how can you not get a little bit emotional, really? So that's all fine. But the other thing that around this time is probably needing to be discussed is your potential of when you are going to be discharging from the postnatal facility. Because the milk, your full milk, doesn't tend to arrive until around day 3 or 4, then I certainly hesitate that any woman, especially a first-time mother, is getting discharged before then. You really should not be getting discharged until you are clinically ready for discharge. And part of being clinically ready is knowing that your breastfeeding has been successfully established. And it's not possible to know your breastfeeding has been successfully established until your breast full milk has arrived and the baby is latching well and suckling productively with fantastic swallows. So don't rush home. Your goal, honestly, the best, most important thing you can be doing right now is making the definitive decision that you are not walking through your front door when you get home until you have got breastfeeding fantastically established and you're not still scratching your head just going, oh yeah, I think I get it, when you don't. Okay. So now let us move on to the baby. Exciting. So a few things going on there. So firstly, day 2 babies, what they want to do is just feed, 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 feed. What is that? Feed, 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 feed. So yeah, day 1, they can sort of have some feeds and do a really long catch-up sleep sometimes. And we call it the recovery sleep. They might sleep for 5 or 6, even 7 hours. And that's actually okay in that first 24 hours, as long as they only do it once, because otherwise they really do need some food. But once they've recovered, ooh, feed, 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 feed. Yes, you need to have had the most sleep you can possibly have on that first 24 hours, because you're not going to get a lot on the next 24 hours. And you'll probably feel like your nipples are about to fall off. They are so sore. I always say to women, look, even with the most fantastic, perfect latch, to say that that should be painless, I'm sorry for all the lactation consultants who will insist that it should be painless. It just, I disagree. You know, if you take any piece of your anatomy, even if it's your little finger or your little toe, and you suck on it for 8 to 10 hours every 24 hours, it's probably going to be a little sore, even with a fantastic latch. But certainly having a good latch is absolutely critical to not having ongoing difficulty and with breastfeeding and having incredibly traumatized nipples. Certainly the trauma to the nipples should not be occurring, and that is usually a sign of a poor latch. And the only way you're going to get a good latch is when you've got some really fantastic one-on-one assistance with somebody who knows how to breastfeed. So that's a midwife, a lactation consultant, or an auntie or a mother or a girlfriend who has done a lot of breastfeeding. Let's say they have successfully breastfed, you know, 3 or 4 babies, to be handing out advice. Yeah, because every baby's different. So, you know, certainly we want to know that that baby will be going feed, 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 and that's completely normal. Belly button or their umbilicus should not be looking angry and red. It is very common for it to be a little bit wet. There's nothing, no special treatment that has to be done unless it's looking very angry and red. The baby sometimes can get a little bit of conjunctivitis or a little bit of sticky eye, pink eye, and that is really contagious from one eye to the other. So it's very important that when you clean their eyes that you go from inside out and then get another piece of the little muslin flannel cloth and do the other eye inside out, okay? Make sure you don't cross-contaminate that baby's eyes. Few drops of breast milk into their eyes every time you breastfeed. I am not kidding you. It is miraculous. It's full of antibodies and it's the best thing for getting rid of conjunctivitis. So you want baby to have done at least one pee in the first 24 hours. But from that point onwards, they really should be doing a few pees every day. But it can be hard to tell, especially when they're on colostrum, because it's such tiny amounts that they're drinking. Sometimes only 5 or 10 or 15 mils is their entire feed. And by the time it comes out as a little tiny wee, it can be very easy to not even be able to see it within. Disposable nappies are so absorbent. So do a little bit of tissue or toilet paper, Kleenex, I think, but in a layer between the baby's skin and the nappy, because then if it's wet, you know that they've weed, right? And that can just be helpful. Now, further down the track, when they're drinking way bigger volumes, well, you won't need to do that because you'll just be able to tell that you've got a very heavy, full nap. But at this stage, with the diapers, it is important to be able to identify that they're having some wheeze. And once your full milk arrives, then they talk about sort of that babies should be doing half a dozen wet nappies a day. I disagree. I think babies only doing half a dozen are only just kind of hanging in there. And actually, the goal should be 10 to 12. And if your baby's doing 10 to 12 wet nappies after your full milk has arrived every day, well, I tell you, that baby is arriving. They're doing awesomely well. Now the poo, so day one and day two, it is usually that black sticky poo called meconium. Then around sort of day three or four, it starts to become transitional, which is like a greeny yellow color. And then by day five or earlier, or day six at the very latest, but really preferably day five or four, they should be doing bright yellow mustard color or porpoise color poos. So as I say, at this stage, we're still day two, so we're still talking about the black, dark, greeny, black tar meconium color. So long as the baby is 100% breast milk fed and they are making lots of wet nappies, it never matters what the consistency is of the poo, as long as it is not little hard rocks like pebbles, which it never is with a fully breastfed baby. They're always well hydrated, those babies. But sometimes with a formula fed baby, particularly in the height of summer, they can actually get a little bit dehydrated and their poos are naturally more formed. But you know, I know that I've had so many parents over the years be worried that their baby's got diarrhea because their poo looks like diarrhea, but it's supposed to look like that. So as I say, as long as they're making lots of wet nappies, it doesn't matter what the consistency of the poo is, it's fine. All right, now there's going to be a couple of screens that will be done, baby, which you need to feel confident that you are able to give an informed consent for those to occur. You need to feel like you are actually informed. So there's something called the hearing screen, which hopefully is done in wherever you live. And the hearing screen kind of works on what we call the 1-3-6 goals. Somewhere, now the one stands for the first month. So somewhere in the first month, your baby should have a hearing screen, where basically all that happens is that the technician will send some sound waves down their eardrum and measure the bounce back. So all that's really telling us is that there is a eardrum present, because otherwise it wouldn't bounce back. So that's fantastic. But sometimes if there's a bit of sort of water in the air at all, if it's done sort of almost a bit too quickly after the baby's been born, you know, let's say they were born at night and then the next morning someone's trying to do a hearing screen, they might still have a bit of water in their ears. Or if they've just had a bath, they could have a bit of water in their ears and that could give an inconsistent result. So somewhere in the first month, and it can be done easily while they're just asleep. In fact, it's almost easier to do it when they're asleep. They, as I say, they send this little sound waves into the eardrums to measure the bounce back. So that stands for the one of this 1-3-6 goals. Now the three means, and audiology post-test assessment done in the first 3 months, which means that if there seems to be anything a little bit of a question mark on the hearing screen, the next step is typically a higher level hearing screen done, and that should be done somewhere in the first 3 months, right? You can also do your own unscientific hearing test as well, where you just do something like slam a door, and if the baby startles, well, that just told you they heard it. You could do that if you even need reassurance. And then the 6 of the 136 goal is that by 6 months of age, if it is confirmed that there are some hearing issues, that then by 6 months of age, there should be some kind of intervention of education services starting to be offered to you to look after that baby who's got some hearing deficit. So that's the hearing screen. And then the other screen that occurs is something called the Guthrie's heel prick. It's also often been called the PKU test, which stands as the code name for phenylketonuria. How do you say it? Phenylketonuria. I'm not good at saying that one. But that's only one of the metabolic disorders that it tests for these days. So it's better, more accurately referred to as a Guthrie's heel prick screen. That's basically should occur as soon as possible within after 48 hours after the baby had its first feed. So typically, because your baby usually we had a feed in the first couple of hours, so if we said, you know, anytime from sort of 50 hours onwards, preferably somewhere within 50 to 70 hours after that baby was born, soon as possible, basically, so that you can receive the results as soon as possible. That's why. It is checking for some rare metabolic disorders. Their rarity, sort of depending on the country you live in, it's usually about half a dozen rare disorders and sometimes more than that. And things like congenital hypothyroidism, cystic fibrosis, etc. And the rarity goes anywhere from about one in, let's say, about 5,000 to one in 150,000, depending on what they're checking for. But these are rare metabolic disorders, but they are all disorders generally that if we wait until that baby or child starts to display symptoms of that disorder, then chances are some damage has been done to them. So that's why it's really important that the sooner you would know about that, the better. So make sure that does get done. And look, the discomfort the baby is that they have their heel prick. Their heel pricked to collect a little bit of blood on a card. You know, for the consequence of not knowing that they have a rare metabolic disorder and the terrible damage that could do, oh my goodness, why would you not do the test? And let's face it, if that baby was born prematurely, you know, especially the real early ones, they would all be getting blood tests done multiple times a day sometimes to check for blood sugar levels and other things. So, you know, for one screen, I think in all my time as a midwife, I can only ever recall one parent refusing to have that done. So, and although it does require, of course, parental consent, you know, I encourage you to consent to it, but, you know, make sure that you do feel well informed about what it's all about. Now, in general terms, usually about sort of, let's say, roughly 100 of those tests will need to get re-screened. And that's not necessarily because there's suspicion of any of there being a metabolic disorder, but typically it's just because the sample wasn't fantastic. So they just want another fresh sample is typically what happens because, you know, as I say, the disorders generally go from 1 in 5,000 up to about 1 in 150,000 and about 1 in 100 cards needs to be retested. So obviously it's mostly because of the sample not being quite what they want. Now, oh, the last thing I want to talk about, yes, I've got a little list here because I don't want to miss anything. SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome. These days it's also called SUDI, or sudden unexplained death in infancy, and it is what used to be called COP death. So you should be feeling well informed as to the things that you should do and should not do to make sure that you give your baby the best chance possible to not have COP death. Okay, so just know that they talk about the first 12 months, but actually it's really for the under 6 to 8 month old, and especially the under 2 to 4 month old. It is actually very rare for a baby over 8 months of age to have SIDS. That's doesn't very happen very much, but sometimes when health departments giving information out to the public, they do dumb it down. I'm sorry, but they do. They sort of try to make things very simple and generalized. And so just telling everybody the first year means that, you know, hopefully most parents will pay attention to it for, you know, hopefully 9 or 10 months. So that's what's going on there. But certainly after 8 months particularly, don't be too freaking out about things. In that first 6 months, you really particularly, you want to make sure that the baby is lying on their back. It's basically no tummy sleeping. And because we know there is definitely a correlation between tummy sleeping and cot death. In fact, I had the honour of working with alongside the professor for a year who was discovered all this research and changed it all around the world. Anyway, it is okay. That now the problem is that when we did this big change from saying no tummy sleeping, back only, we started to get a lot of problems with babies getting flat heads because they were always only on their back. So there's been a softening of things in recent times. We're sort of saying, look, it's okay for them to lie on their sides as well, all right? But not, they mustn't lie on their sides in such a way that they could potentially accidentally roll onto their tummy. So it's not really on their full side, all right? You're talking about just a little bit of an angle so that they're not flat. They've just got their head a little bit of a tilt. The thing that I found the easiest way to accomplish that is to use those triangular pillows that sort of go down the side of the baby and stops them rolling over but allows them to have a little bit of a tilt. Or you can roll up a towel and just sort of put it on their side or put it underneath the base sheet and just to tilt them a little bit, all right, is what you're after. No co-sleeping with a drunk or stoned parent. We're not going to say no co-sleeping because that's a very common thing within a lot of cultures. There is no verdict as to whether that's definitely a bad thing or not, because co-sleeping is part of a lot of indigenous cultures and there's a lot of positive things to co-sleeping as well. But so what we say is basically say is so long as the parent is not drunk or stoned. Now, this also includes baby lying on daddy's tummy when he's had a few beers on a Saturday afternoon and he's watching the cricket and then he's fallen asleep. So that's not okay. So babies have slipped down between cushions while parents have been sleeping. Not all right. So you just have to be really careful on that. Babies have not died of cot death. They've actually died of asphyxiation, not an unexplained death, a very explainable death. They've slipped down between cushions or between pillows or between parents. With the co-sleeping, there are some fantastic little baskets that you can put into a bed so that the baby has no chance of slipping down between you but is still very, very physically close to you. Or you can get bassinets that attach to your bed and again, there's no chance of the baby slipping down between cushions. Use a firm mattress for the baby. I mean, not so firm that it's like concrete and it's going to turn its head flat. Basically, you're saying not very soft mattresses that they can kind of get a bit drowned in them, and not water beds, you know, that just completely give way to whatever weight is on them. Avoid everything that curves the baby's neck inwards, because let's face it, they don't have much of a neck. Yeah, you don't want it curving inwards. So don't use things like pillow, like don't put a pillow underneath their neck because they don't need it, because their chin might do this. And certainly when they're lying in the curve of a car seat, you want to take them out of that curve as soon as possible so they lie flat, not lying all shunt, crunched up. You know, so often, you know, absolutely have them in the car seat when they in the car. But using the car seat and clicking it into one of those little trundlers to push along with their neck all curved in while they're sleeping, or keeping them in it and carrying them into rooms or wherever you're going while they're sleeping, that's not a good idea. You should have a pram that's got a very flat bed to it as to when they are sleeping, and only have them sleeping in the car seat when they're actually in the car. Smoke-free home, you should know that. Don't allow them to get too hot, but at the same time, we don't want them to get cold stressed. Look, if you're ever not sure if they're overheated, just get a thermometer, put it underneath their armpit. As long as they are not high 37s, then they're not cold, they're not too hot. They should be high 36s or low 37s. Oh, there's quite a lot, two more things on this. There's quite a lot of commentary that sort of says that breastfeeding assists to reduce the chances of cot death. There's no proper research on that. So, in fact, some of the lowest rate countries with some of the lowest rate of cot death have some of the lowest rates of breastfeeding. So that is actually, I've got to be honest, a little bit of propaganda. There's not solid, great research on that. And so for any mother who is unable to breastfeed, now we know that for copious other reasons, breast milk is the best thing for a baby. But if you are a mum who's perhaps had a mastectomy and you're unable to breast milk feed your baby, well, you know, don't feel that they're at more high risk for cot death, because that's not really true. Okay, and then the last thing is, I can't recommend enough the Dr. Sprott Baby Safe mattresses, mattress covers. Now, this is not something, unfortunately, I think, in my opinion, that the cot death type societies have really embraced, but I've looked at his research and I think it's pretty impressive that he's found a real correlation between the age of a mattress and basically the increasing the chances of sudden infant death syndrome. So he recommends getting a new mattress for every baby, or at least getting a cover, one of his covers of mattresses. And feel free to go onto his website. It's a little bit old because he's kind of old fashioned himself. He's quite an eclectic man and he's passionate on this topic, and he's a good guy. But his website is www.cotlife2000, so cotlife2000.co.nz, and read for yourself. And I think that's a great thing to do. So look, that's everything for today about day two. Do have a wonderful rest of your week. I wish you all the best.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast today. Visit kathyfrey.com for lots more free maternity information and downloads. Plus, you can order copies of Kathy's books, browse through her top recommended motherhood products, and check out her popular support package options. KathyFrey.com.